Welcome to Switzerland in Sound, produced and presented by Bob Zanotti.
Peter Holler, we have three main topics on our agenda today. Let's start from the top and look at the latest security report that everyone was waiting for. It was issued by the Minister of Defense, Uli Maurer. And it was controversial, and it was criticized by both the left and the right. Can you bring us in the picture?
Yes, you can basically say that the security report is an unwanted piece of homework imposed on the federal government or cabinet by parliament, and it includes a regular security report which comes out every few years. And basically, Defense Ministry is supposed to know what's going to happen in the world in the next few years. Mr. Maurer's first two attempts at this report last year were sent back by the cabinet because it included stuff they didn't want to read about and didn't include what they wanted to hear. Now, you have to see that Mr. Maurer is the only member of the right-wing People's Party in the cabinet, and he is basically against Swiss involvement in any kind of foreign dealings, including sending Swiss troops abroad for peace support missions. But the cabinet is for this, and his report didn't respect the policy of security through cooperation, which has been adopted by this country for the last 15 years, and includes partnership for peace as one of its tenets. Mr. Maurer basically wanted to cut back on the international peace support operations, and the cabinet wants to keep them in. So now the report is sort of a compromise. And as Mr. Maurer says, it doesn't make any difference anyway, because it's parliament that decides on peace support operations, not the cabinet and not the minister.
So in other words, the People's Party has a very conservative, traditional view of Swiss defense, and that is basically isolationism, in the sense that Switzerland does not go abroad. It defends its territory at home. It's a defensive army and not an active army. But this, as you describe it, is not the policy of the present federal cabinet. They want a more open policy. They want soldiers to participate in Kosovo. They want Swiss soldiers to be sent abroad to UN peacekeeping missions and so on. Is that a fair oversimplification?
Yes, you could basically say, and of course nowadays the Swiss don't even want to go in for peacekeeping, because that could mean using force, so it's called peace support operations. And basically, yes, you can say that the Swiss People's Party is in favor of traditional Swiss neutrality and of a strong Swiss army, but only for home defense and nothing more.
Well, cynics often say that a compromise is a solution designed to please nobody. If we look at it from that point of view, will this report suddenly or slowly disappear and die a peaceful death? In other words, in effect, it doesn't sound like a very relevant document.
No, I think as I said in at the beginning, it's really a punishment imposed on the cabinet by parliament, which wants to flex its muscles. But I remember in the early 90s, one of the security reports, and it was a rather intellectually brilliant report, said that the main threat facing Europe and Switzerland is the threat of medium-range missiles from the Near East, or from, for instance, from Iran, and that Europe should cooperate in setting up a missile defense shield against rocket threats from the Middle East. And as we know, in the last 15 or 20 years, nothing has happened in that direction. And I suspect everything written in this security report will end up the same way.
Strategic and military critics, some of them with rather well-known names, have criticized the Swiss concept of defense, simply saying it's not up to date. It's from another age, another time. You mention the danger of rocket attacks from abroad. Basically, according to the critics, the Swiss Army is simply not geared for this kind of work.
It's geared for the modern world the same way everybody was geared for 9/11. And Mr. Maurer said that's the whole problem with all these security reports. Nobody predicted 9/11. And usually what happens in the world, take the example of volcanic ash, it happens without anybody having a plan on how to deal with it.
So the essence of defense, I suppose, is flexibility and a quick response that will remain in this case as well.
That's what Mr. Mara said. Basically, you have to be prepared for the unexpected. And of course, that is very, very difficult.
Now, let's turn to the Swiss Penal Code. Let me preface this by saying that in my 40 years in this country, as a working journalist and also as a citizen of the country, I can't help but escape the impression that the Swiss Penal Code is, to be polite, very lenient. Nobody seems to go up to jail for almost anything in this country. If you're going to be done by the police and by the system, it seems Switzerland is a great place to be. It's almost like a country club atmosphere. Am I painting a correct picture here, a correct background?
No, I think unfortunately you're right. And basically, the last revision of the Penal Code, which only dates back 3 years, was even more lenient or even more lax. It introduced, for instance, things replacing jail sentences, even suspended jail sentences, with suspended fines. In other words, if you, for instance, defrauded somebody, you would get, for example, a fine of 3,000 francs, Swiss francs, 3,000 US dollars, but you would only have to pay that fine if you committed the offense again. And in other words, there's practically no punishment available for any number of offenses. Short suspended jail terms were abolished. For instance, deportation of foreign criminals was also abolished. And now, after 3 years, the present Justice and Police Minister, Evelyn Widmer-Schlumpf, has decided, and I think she's probably got the support of the whole Swiss nation as well as Parliament, that the screws will have to be turned a bit tighter in future. And we have to see that over 50% of Switzerland's jailbirds are foreigners. But under the revision of the Penal Code, this was dropped, so there's no more deportation except as an administrative measure afterwards. And basically, Mrs. Widmer-Schlumpf wants to reintroduce this into the Penal Code. And I think you could really say that most of the population would be on her side.
And finally, let's turn to Switzerland's largest bank, the UBS, which has been in and out of the headlines now for the better part of a year because of its problems with the United States, the Internal Revenue Service, helping American citizens and others, presumably, avoid taxes and so on and so forth. Most everyone has heard about the story. To bring it up to date, there was the annual shareholders meeting in Basel not long ago. And for the first time, if the commentators are accurate and correct, for the first time in memory, in corporate or banking memory, the shareholders have gone against the recommendation of the bank directorate, and they want the heads, basically, of the people who are responsible for getting the UBS into the disastrous economic state that it got into. And here we're thinking of the former chairman, Marcel Ospel, and one or two of his associates. The shareholders basically want him to face trial. How likely is this to happen?
Well, basically what the shareholders did was they didn't discharge the old board members from their legal responsibilities for the year 2007.
In other words, they wouldn't let them off the hook.
That's right. But in fact, if you like, this situation has already been preempted because a few months ago, the Social Democratic Party, as well as many other shareholders, wanted the Zurich public prosecutors to arraign Mr. Ospel, to start a lawsuit against him. But basically, the public attorney said twice there wasn't any material which would stand up in a court of law against Mr. Ospel and his fellow directors. There's no element of fraud. There's no element of cheating. It was just bad business practice at the most, or bad luck.
The word mismanagement has been used by some financial experts, but this doesn't necessarily constitute a crime in this country, does it?
Well, I don't think it constitutes a crime in anywhere else either, because if you brought every bank manager up in court for mismanagement, there wouldn't be any banks left in the world. And I think certainly, obviously, the groundswell is now against the banks and the banking system, especially from the left. But in concrete terms, it's very hard to find facts which will nail somebody and accuse them of bad will. Because the other thing is, there has to be either premeditation or ill will to make a charge of mismanagement stick and make it criminally effective.
So in practical terms, it's a slap on the wrist for Mr. Ospel, but nothing more.
It's a slight psychological slap on the wrist. I mean, the other aspect of this case is it's become totally ideological. And for instance, the farcical aspect of it was at the annual general meeting of UBS. There was a speaker, the main financial speaker, an MP, accusing the banks of all sorts of malpractice and so on. And the only reason she was even at that meeting was because the Social Democratic Party of Switzerland bought one share in UBS, so they had the right to play to the gallery at the meeting. But really, it's not really politically very important.
Okay, Peter Holler, Switzerland in Sounds, political correspondent and analyst. Thank you very much indeed.
This is a very special moment for me for a couple of reasons. When I was a student in New York back in the early 1960s, I ran a weekly radio talk show, and it dealt with all kinds of what we called offbeat subjects: flying saucers, spiritualism, unexplained events, this kind of thing. And I loved it. And then the program went off the air as I went on to other things, and I thought that was a chapter in my life that was finished. And then along came today's guest on Switzerland in Sound, and his name needs no introduction. It's known all over the world, Eric von Däniken. Now, Eric von Däniken is the world's leading best-selling nonfiction author, 28 books, 62 million copies in print in dozens of languages. And what maybe you don't know is that he is Swiss. And he's also the father of a concept called the Mystery Park, which is the latest real big attraction in Switzerland, and it's located right here in Interlaken in the Bernese Oberland, where we're sitting right now. We're in Mystery Park. Now, Eric von Däniken, in case you're one or two of the people on this planet who haven't heard his name, has made his name famous through his investigation, research, and writings about the unexplained. And that, Eric von Däniken, makes you one of the most difficult men for any journalist to interview, because the journalist needs a label for somebody, and you defy labels. How would you describe yourself and what it is you're writing about?
First of all, my name has become popular with my first book in the 60s. It was called Chariots of the Gods. Later, In Search of Ancient Gods, and all my titles have to do with some of the gods. Now, the basic idea was, and still is, some thousands and thousands of years ago, at the time when our forefathers were still primitive Stone Age people, some extraterrestrials landed here. Now, our Stone Age people could not understand what was going on, and they believed, erroneously by the way, that these extraterrestrials must be some gods. Of course, we all know there are no gods. There's just one god, the god of religion. But that's how it was handed down. The gods were here. The gods helped to educate man. So this is the basic idea of all my researches.
And this you find in all so-called primitive civilizations. They all left artifacts, or at least mention of this, behind.
First, they left, most of them left writings. You have a very antique literature in ancient India, which clearly expresses that at that time, gigantic cities, they call it cities, surrounded the earth and the firmament. And out of these cities, smaller vehicles came. The old Indians called them the Vimanas. And these Vimanas are described in the old Indian text so precisely that we were able to reconstruct them piece by piece. And of course, we show these things in the Mystery Park. But even in the Bible, by the way, I'm still a deep believer in God, and I am educated as a Christian Catholic. Still in the Bible, you find some of these references. For example, take the Old Testament and look at the prophet Ezekiel. There you see that Ezekiel describes a vehicle coming down from the clouds, and he described the noise the vehicle made. He compares the noise with the thundering of a waterfall, and he describes the wings and the wheels and the feet and all details. So we have a chariot of the God even in the description of the Old Testament. So I looked at all these with my own eyes, with modern eyes, and I looked for my own interpretation. And the result now finally is the mystery park.
And as far as the Hindus are concerned, I believe, Eric von Däniken, there's no question in their mind what the so-called flying saucers or spatial visitations are.
Definitely. They called it vimanas, and they described them absolutely precisely. And there were different types of vimanas. As today, we have different types of aircrafts. We have jumbo jets, helicopters, military aircrafts, and so on. Indian literature, the ancient Indian literature, is very, very large. There are thousands and thousands of pages.
And they have no problem with this subject at all. It's, to them, it's just part of life or part of history.
Whenever I have a public speech in a university in India, be it in Bombay or Calcutta, so the auditorium is crowded, overcrowded of people, and they really have no problem with them. We have problems here in the Western world because of our religious educations, but in ancient India there were always different gods, so-called gods. Everyone had its quality and had its duty to do, and so for us it's complicated, not for the old Indian.
You also are known for work that you've done in relationship to South America, something described already in the 1920s as like a launching ramp for a rocket right on the equator, which is exactly the way you'd have to build it if you wanted to launch a rocket. Now, one of the fascinating things, Eric von Däniken, is that you actually go to places, you see it for yourself, you read the literature, you talk to people who have gone through this and have done other research, and you bring it, you focus it in one place. You don't make up these stories. You can back up everything you say.
Definitely. Whatever I write exists. If I quote ancient texts so you can control them, they are there. Or if I bring some artifacts or whatever it is somewhere in the world, you can control it, you can photograph it. The problem is the interpretation. Eric von Däniken looks at these things with his own eyes, while some conservative scientists see it with their eyes, which is okay with me. Everyone has its personal opinion. Now, you just referred to Peru. In Peru, we have what you call the launching pad. It's in a place called Samaipata, in today's Bolivia. But what is even crazier is this gigantic desert in Peru with the name of Nazca. When you are on the ground of the desert of Nazca, you see nothing. The usual desert. You see dunes, you see sand, you see dried stones, and that's it. But soon, as you fly with an aircraft over the same desert, out of the desert, first you see gigantic figures, figures of fishes, monkeys, birds, spiders, but of such overdimensional size that you can see them only from the air. The next thing, when you fly higher with your aircraft, you see something which remains, it looks like airstrips. By the way, I never said that these were the landing strips of extraterrestrials. All true, I'm always quoted like that.
But they just look like it.
Yes, they look like. Now we are in the mystery park, as you said in the beginning, and for the mystery park we filmed this gigantic desert in helicopters. One camera we pointed in front of us, and the other one right on the bottom. So we worked with two cameras at the same time. Here in the mystery park, you go in a pavilion with the name Nazca, and you sit in an auditorium. In front of you is a big screen, but this screen continues under your feet. It's a glass bottom projection. You always have the impression of sitting on a flying carpet. Now you have an earphone on your head, and on this earphone you shortly hear every scientific explanation, but very, very brief, one phrase or two. But it all ends with question mark. You never receive an answer. This is for the whole mystery park, so. So after a show of 12 minutes, you leave this pavilion of Nazca with the impression of having seen something which does exist, which is absolutely fantastic.
There's no discussion. This exists.
Absolutely exists. And it was presented with high technology, but our scientific community accept 10 theories. We have nothing in our hands.
It's classified as paranormal. We don't have any explanation. But Eric von Däniken does. What is your personal explanation for these and some of the other leading mysteries of the world?
Well, Nazca is one of the explanations I know, and I know it from the ancient Indian literature, and not only from them. that thousands of years ago an extraterrestrial mother spaceship surrounded the Earth. Now, if a crew is for centuries flying somewhere between stars and stars, and they arrive in a new solar system, what they first need is energy. Whatever the energy is, maybe they need radioactivity, maybe they need uranium or whatever. Whatever, we don't know. Now they measure from the orbit where on this planet they will find this energy. And then they send a smaller vehicle down. Today we would call it a shuttle. And this shuttle makes some measurements in the desert of Nazca, for example, because Nazca still today is the greatest mine in South America. You find everything there. And so they make measurement, and finally maybe they send some robot vehicle down to pick up their energy. The natives, who don't understand what was going on, the natives watch the doings of the so-called gods from a faraway distance. And after the gods have left again with their energy, now the natives come out of the desert. And they see some traces in the desert. And now they believe that these traces have been made by the gods, and the natives now start to create signs in the ground. Spiders, monkeys, birds and so on. But all these signs of such overdimensional size that only the gods from the air can see them. So that's my basic idea. If the answer is correct or not, I don't know, and I do not insist of it.
Of course, the cynic will say, yeah, this was a modern phenomenon. Someone went out there in the middle of the night and made all of these markings. I assume this has all been checked scientifically to establish the age of these markings.
Yes, but this is a big controversy. Our archaeology, which is a very wonderful science, they always find new tombs, and they find new ceramics. So out came other datings and other results. And they say, well, this culture made it, or this culture made it. In the meantime, we have found tombs in near Nazca, which date back to 3000 BC, while the youngest of these signs are only about 600 AD. So between 3000 BC and 600 AD, you have a very big discrepancy. So who made the signs? And what was the first one, the oldest one? And what was the purpose for it? What was the basic idea? What influenced the natives to do these things? So these are the questions which Eric von Däniken comes up with.
And they're also very, very old, and these have, of course, been chronicled and documented even scientifically. Old pictures depicting people wearing what we would call today spacesuits, looking like diving helmets and so on. This was done by natives thousands of years ago.
Definitely, and we find them all over the world. The biggest of them, 8 meters high, you find in the Sahara Desert in today's Algeria. But you find references all over the world, so you have two possible explanations. It's psychologically, or they all saw something similar.
Or everyone on Earth was collectively hallucinated.
Yes, exactly.
Unlikely.
Yeah, unlikely. So.
What about the eternal mystery that has fascinated mankind for millennia, and that is the pyramids of Egypt? Everyone asks, how were they built? Who built them? They're mysterious in the way they were even constructed, with their orientation towards celestial bodies and so on. What do you feel we actually know at this point about the pyramids, and who built them and how?
Again, we have two opinions. The one is the classical archaeology, which says the Great Pyramid of Egypt was constructed by a pharaoh with the name of Cheops. Cheops is dated about 2,500 BC, which means about 4,500 years from now. And in the Great Pyramid are only two rooms, the so-called King's Chamber and the Queen's Chamber. And finally, the whole pyramid was done within 20 years. 100,000 people worked for it. So this is the scientific opinion. But these wonderful scientists, they do not know the Arabian historians. I sometimes ask the scientists, the Egyptologists, have you ever read a book of Ibrahim Abdul Al-Mas'udi? And they look at me and say, Al-what? I say, Al-Mas'udi, Arabian historian, 12th century, yeah. 8 historian books. Or have you ever read a book of Al-Makrisi, which is another historian? So we don't know these old texts. I know them, that's my profession. And in the old Arabian literature, this is a complete different story than what we know today, or what we believe that we know today.
What is their version?
They say the whole pyramid, the Great Pyramid, was created before the Great Flood. Mankind, humans, were at that time so primitive that they eat and drink together with the animals on the same river. Then the heavens opened, and out of the heavens small barks, ships, have come down.
Sounds familiar.
Sounds familiar, yes. And the gods have descended. And these gods first teached mankind to write. They teach them in astronomy. They teach them in different belongings. And the gods knew that a great flood would come and would destroy mankind. So one of the humans, his name was Saurit. And it's interesting to know that the Arabian historians say Saurit is the same which the Hebrew community calls Enoch. And Enoch, again, is the first, according to the Bible or Jewish tradition, who left this planet in a fiery chariot. Now back, the Arabian call it Saurit. So he was the most intelligent, and they teach him in writing. And he wrote different books about the stories before the Great Flood. He constructed the Great Pyramid. In the Great Pyramid are different rooms, and in the rooms are all these books. Now, this is Arabian tradition. Our modern science says this is all rubbish.
What do they know about it?
The fact is, some 10 years ago, a small robot entered into one of the unknown shafts in the Great Pyramid. And the scientific community believed that the shaft is only about 10 meters. Reality, it was 64 meters long. And after the 64 meters run inside the pyramid, the robot ended before a little door. And the little door had two metallic bracelets. In the meantime, they have been digging a hole into this door, and behind the first door was a second door. So there are rooms in the pyramids, as the Arabian tradition says. The question now is, what is in these rooms? But definitely we found rooms in the Great Pyramid. So the mystery continues. By the way, in the mystery park, you see the original robot who was in the pyramid.
That's on display right here.
On display right here. And you see every possible theory which is reasonable how the Great Pyramid could have been constructed. There are 12 of them.
It seems, and this is not new, I've heard this over the years, there is an arrogance in Western so-called science, a closed-mindedness which is the opposite of what it should be, and a lot of arrogance vis-a-vis some of the original writers of this in this field of those nationalities. You mentioned the case of Egypt. There are historians, there are archaeologists in South America who I know, as a matter of fact, were literally laughed at by Western and especially European scientists. Do you agree with this feeling of arrogance and closed-mindedness on the part of Western science?
Well, definitely yes. I mean, I learned it in my own experience.
Yeah, you went through it.
When I came out with Chariots of the Gods in 1968, I was just laughed and criticized and crashed down practically all over the world, but especially here in the European states. While in the United States, I had in 1969 and 1970-71 a lot of speeches and discussions on universities, colleges and high schools, but not here in Europe. So here, they have a special way of thinking. You know, the professors are the ones who are the highest, and then comes the students or whatever, and finally comes nothing, just the public. The public is stupid.
Don't forget the New Age, which is a general phrase not everybody likes, but at least the New Age was an American phenomenon. It started there. It's still very strong there and getting stronger, and people do seem to be more open-minded for this. But also here in Europe, I have a feeling that your audiences in Switzerland and Germany in particular, possibly in Britain, are open-minded to this more and more. What has been your own personal experience? You've traveled the world lecturing all over the place.
Well, in the meantime, and I have to say, since Chariots of the Gods, nearly 35 years have passed. In the meantime, I am accepted here by most of the reasonable and modern scientists. Some of the conservative scientists, like theologians or conservative archaeologists, they still don't like me, but they never understand the story, and they never read my books. They still believe that Erich von Däniken says that extraterrestrials created the Great Pyramid, or extraterrestrials made gigantic temples on Earth. This was never my idea. I always said the humans did it, but the question was, for what purpose? why and with what technology, with what knowledge. So they misunderstood me.
But you, Eric von Däniken, do not deny the existence of extraterrestrials. I mean, that to you, it is a fact that the Earth was visited upon by extraterrestrials, people from other planetary and solar systems in millennia gone by. But what exactly was their contribution to our life on Earth? Indeed, wasn't it even our life directly, our life itself? This is one theory.
It becomes very complicated. Of course, we have an evolution here. Of course, we know we came, if I say it on a non-scientific term, we came from the family of apes, whatever it is, gorillas, chimpanzees, one of the family tree. But the question is, we are the only intelligent being on this planet. And with intelligent, I mean culture, religion, painting.
We can reason.
We can reason and all these things. So the question is, why? Why only we from this family tree? And every old tradition, including the Bible, by the way, says the gods, in plural, not in singular, the gods created man after their own image or according their own image. Now, for decades, we could never understand this. We have had a misunderstanding between evolution and between religion beliefs. And I think that there is no misunderstanding. Both opinions are correct. Just imagine, we have an evolution on Earth, so we come from the family of apes. One day, maybe 50,000 years ago for the first time, an extraterrestrial spaceship lands here, which was not coincidence, but that's another story. As accepted, they found different forms of life here. One form of life was the most advanced one, our primitive forefathers. They took one exemplary of them and simply take one cell. And from the cell, they take the DNA code and change the basic code in the DNA.
We do this today.
We do this today.
No magic.
No magic. Now, the cell grows, and finally they put the product into the womb of a female of the same species. This female will give birth to a child. The child has definitive the evolution, I mean the bones, the skeletons and these things. But because of this artificial mutation, not the natural, an artificial mutation, this child has something in plus, which the rest of the family tree has not. Soon as you want to have a new population out of the family tree, you need at least two, female and male. And then you land in the legend of Adam and Eve. The gods created humans according to their own image. This does not contradict evolution. You still can live with evolution, but you have a missing link, which is the artificial mutation made by these extraterrestrials. And by the way, and we all know it, we feel it, we have it in the religious feeling, these extraterrestrials who were here thousands of years ago, they will return. We all expect it. They will return one day. They promised it to our forefathers. They will return. We still have it in every religion, this expectation of somebody who will return.
But what about today, Eric von Däniken? This is one of the big questions of the moment. Are we still being visited by extraterrestrials? There are strong believers who say we're visited more than we ever were. What evidence do you have of this?
Not much. Of course, I'm familiar with many of the UFO books, the whole literature. I have to know it, it's my profession. But I myself, unfortunately, I never saw a UFO. Sometimes I have the impression when Eric von Däniken shows up, they fly away. But also, we have not only popular sightings in the UFO field, we have at least some scientific literature in the UFO field.
And military evidence, if we believe what's claimed.
So I really think that from time to time, somebody is watching us, somebody is observing us, and they treat us well, they don't interrupt us, and they don't destroy us, and they are quite fair in a distance to observe.
Except those who, according to some claims, actually come down and still perform medical experiments on human beings, particularly women, which is quite an interesting parallel to what you described a few moments ago. They actually get earthly women pregnant, and the women describe, even under hypnosis, under controlled scientific circumstances, the procedure of the operation, and are terrified as a result.
I understand this, and I know these stories since at least 17 years. And in the beginning, I never believed them. I said, that's all rubbish. Come on, they are.
You don't believe them?
In the meantime, I do some of it. Because in the meantime, I know very well Professor John Mack. Mack, Harvard University, who came up with one of these books. And we have had quite some discussions together. And he's an honest personality. And he examine some of these female...
With regressive therapy, regressive hypnosis.
And something obviously from time to time goes on.
Well, it was said once, I don't know by whom, maybe by me years ago, for a group of people who literally don't know what's above our heads in the sky and below our feet in the ground, we're an awfully skeptical group of people. We don't tend to believe anything. It takes a lot to convince us.
You see, we have the problem on this planet, generally spoken. I can divide the human beings on this planet in two groups. One group is religious. They have been told that God created everything. He made the plants and the trees and the animals, but as crown of creation, he created us, the human beings. The other group is rather scientifically. They know everything about evolution, mutation, selection, and so on. But on the top of evolution, we stand. Now, have you ever remarked that in both cases, if we are the crown of creation or the top of evolution, in both cases, we are the greatest?
And it's the same thing. It all depends on how you define God.
So we are looking down at our navel. We are egocentric. We, in reality, we don't want extraterrestrials because we are afraid to lose our uniqueness. So if we accept extraterrestrials, we are not the greatest anymore. It's a psychological problem.
Do you agree with one theory that's been put forth that racial differences among human beings is directly attributable to which extraterrestrials they came in contact with?
Who knows?
You know the theory, of course.
I know the theory, of course. And as I said before, for me, practically everything is possible. But I don't know if this is true, but I would never exclude it.
You fought a battle now since the 1960s, 68, when your first book came out, Chariot of the Gods. As you said before, you were laughed at, ridiculed, but things have changed a lot. You've said that yourself. Do you think we're going to see the day soon when we get to the bottom of some of these mysteries?
I think so. These extraterrestrials, who were here thousands of years ago, at some place they left a conclusive proof. And I think we will find this proof. In the meantime, Erik von Däniken has published many books, but only with indications. I never was able to present a conclusive proof in the form of an object. And not a meteorite, an object which is artificial, and definitely not comes from this planet Earth, so that you can show it to the scientific community. So this is still missing. And I think in the next 10 years we will find the conclusive proof here on this Earth. And then probably we will find some traces of extraterrestrials, maybe at some place of the Moon or on Mars. So artificial traces. And who knows, maybe in the next decade we even receive radio signals from them out there. And so finally we will realize that we are not unique in this universe, and the creation, this gigantic creation, was not only made just by the humans. And we become modest again.
You have researched, you have seen, you've heard about so many unexplained mysteries on the face of this earth and even beyond. Out of all of those, which ones would you say are your favorites? Which still captivate most of your imagination and curiosity?
There are two of them. First of all, still the Great Pyramid in Egypt, because I know definitely there are rooms in it. I know it because 11 years ago, an interdisciplinary crew of scientists from the Waseda University in Tokyo has measured the Great Pyramid with most modern technology. I could say X-rayed. It's not correct, but the result is the same. And there is a thick scientific book of it, which of course is secret, and of course I have a copy of it. And there you clearly see in the Great Pyramid a whole labyrinth of channels, shafts, and rooms. But the official science don't want to know about it. But this is a fact. So this still fascinates me. And the other part is Nazca, this desert in Peru, which we just mentioned before. I'm sure at some place in Nazca we will find maybe a microscopic proof, even if it's just dust or whatever, which clearly point to the extraterrestrials.
And one final point, Erik von Däniken, that's on the minds of so many people. We have horrific horror movies and we have science fiction about the destruction of the Earth. If there are extraterrestrials, you and I are among many people believe they are, I don't mind saying, and if they are visiting us, as I'm sure both of us agree, do we have to fear them? Do they have good or bad intentions with us?
Nobody knows. in the past, they were mostly friendly, and they helped our ancestors. They teach them different belongings. In some case, also they destructed. In the old Indian literature, we have whole cities who were destructed by the extraterrestrials, obviously because an experiment went wrong. Or in the Bible, you can come up with the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. There they destroyed the two cities because they were in sin. So you never know which extraterrestrials are returning and if they are good in our sense or evil. I just don't know.
Maybe both.
Maybe both. But I believe, and that's really believe, not knowing, if somebody has a technology to travel these gigantic distances, interstellar distances, from star to star, they should be most advanced and not be primitives again who kill and destroy. So I'm hopeful.
Eric von Däniken, the world's most popular, successful nonfiction writer, world traveler and lecturer, seeker of the truth and discoverer and researcher of the greatest mysteries of the world. If this fascinates you too, the next time you're in Switzerland, please do not miss the Mystery Park here in Interlaken. This is Eric von Däniken's brainchild. It's really a must-see in Switzerland. Eric von Däniken, thank you so much for taking the time in your busy schedule. From Interlaken, for Switzerland and Sound, this is Bob Zanotti.
If you want more information about Switzerland in Sound, check them out online at www.switzerlandinsound.com. Well, thank you very much, Bob Zanotti, for this week's installment of Switzerland in Sound. And if you want more information, once again, the website is www.switzerlandinsound.com. You're listening to PCJ Radio, and I just want to take a few moments to tell you about some of the new things that you can check out at our own website at www.pcjmedia.com. That is, actually, we've just added a new page on the website about Deborah Ray. Now, some of you are saying, who is that? Deborah Ray is an author, but some of you may know her as Dodie Cowan, who for many years hosted His and Hers with her husband Jerry on Radio Netherlands through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Not too long ago, we interviewed Deborah, or Dodie, whichever one you feel more comfortable calling her, about her work at Radio Netherlands and as well as her work as an author. And the shows were so well received that we decided to have a dedicated page for them. So if you go to pcjmedia.com, you'll see it in the lady new, lady. Oh, she is a lady. In the latest news, it is called Deborah Ray, I should say, Dodie Cowan. And you'll find information about her, including the two shows that we did. The first part was about her work at Radio Netherlands and her life as a young girl in Holland. And the second part of the program is an interview with her, but her speaking as Deborah Ray, the author. The author of a book called Rachel Sarai's Vineyard. And there's also a link there for her own weblog, and that's all at pcjmedia.com. We also have a link for some classic Happy Station shows and some bonuses. The shows that are included there are an edition of Happy Station from August 8th, 1959, hosted by Eddie Starts, and it's presented in Spanish. There's also another program from Eddie from June 4th, 1967. That one is in English. And then we have one of Tom's shows, one of the open house shows that he did in the 1970s from February 4th, 1972, which is a lot of fun to listen to. And then we have a special edition that Happy Station did on June 26th, 1994.
The show was presented and produced, I think, probably by the only woman who ever hosted Happy Station. She only did it one time. Her name is Ginger Da Silva, a well-known name at Radio Netherlands. And she talks to Pete Myers, who hosted the show for a couple of years, on his return to Beirut. And may interest you to know, he lived in Beirut for a number of years. And then the bonuses that we have are absolutely fascinating. Now, Radio Netherlands is in a building in Hilversum, which kind of looks like like an airplane. It's especially if you see it from above. It's quite an astonishing building, very well designed building. And in the early 1960s, they did two special programs about moving to the new building. The first one is from the radio series Close Up of Holland, and is produced by John van der Steen, who was an announcer at Radio Netherlands, and he also produced a lot of dramas, about moving to the new studio, which is from June 9th, 1961. And then we have another program about the move called A Farewell to Past Things, which is produced and presented by Jerry Cohen, and features John van der Steen. And it's about a special program looking at the inside of the original Radio Netherlands building that was used from after the Second World War right until the early 1960s. And that program aired on June 16th, 1961. And you can find all those programs at the PCJ Media website. We also have a poll which is taking place, which is, who is your favorite easy listening artist? The choices are James Lass, Roberto Delgado, Bert Klempert, one of Paulette McCrory's favorites, Raycon of Nori Paramore, Tony Hatch, Kai Varner, Werner Mueller, Percy Faith, and Gunter Norris will be announcing the results of the poll next month. At the moment, we have a lead. The lead is James Lass, which is not really much of a surprise, but he's followed closely by Ray Conniff. So you have still another little while to go and vote for your favorite easy listening artist, and we'll be announcing the results on the Happy Station next month. If you want to get in touch with us, you can also get in touch with us via the PCJ Media website at www.pcjmedia.com, as well as a lot of other things as well. Anyway, coming up in a few moments, Paulette McCrory will be here with another edition of Nash Hollis, and then we'll begin the rotation of our programs. Again, Happy Station, Stuff File, Network Europe Week, then some programming from Deutsche Welle, and Switzerland Sound. Oh, sorry, I made a mistake. Coming up next is Finally Fridays, not Nash Hollis. Yes, Finally Fridays with New Hendrixa, all the way in Cape Town, South Africa. Min, yes, that is my South African accent. Hello, min. Yes. Yes, I know, it's very silly. You know, speaking of things South African, the other night when I was watching television, Neil, I came across a film that I hadn't seen in a number of years. Actually, it was two very successful films. The Gods Must Be Crazy and The Gods Must Be Crazy 2. They were running them here in Taiwan on one of the local channels, and I had to say it was a lot of fun. Really a lot of fun. And Neil was probably saying to himself, man, you're crazy to like these films, you know what I mean? Yes, but no, they're not a lot of fun. Anyway, yes, Funny Fridays, Funny Friday, that is, with Neil Hendrixa coming up in just a few moments. To bring us to that point, we are going to take a listen to a little bit more music. Here is Tony Hatch, who is on our poll, with a track called Sounds of the 70s. Now, Tony Hatch is a name that was connected for many years with Petula Clark. He actually wrote the song Downtown. But we're going to take a listen to another composition that he did with his own orchestra from many years ago. This is PCJ Radio.
Minus 3, 2...
Thank you. Hi, this is Bob Zanotti. Do you miss Swiss Radio International? If so, I invite you to visit my website, SwitzerlandInSound.com. Colorful and informative radio features about Switzerland, its destinations, interesting people, politics, culture, and even the two Bobs, SwitzerlandInSound.com, where English language radio from Switzerland lives on.
Hi, I'm Peter Anthony Holder, and I would like you to join me for a very eclectic and different kind of radio show. It's called the Stuff File Program. Where else would you get to hear a well-renowned Hollywood acting teacher, a best-selling science fiction writer, a guy who teaches llamas how to be golf caddies, or the man who has Hitler's toilet, all wrapped up with some of the oddest news stories around? It's a rhetorical question. There's only one place. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. There are various ways to catch the show. You can find it at my website at peteranthonyholder.com. Check out my blog at peteranthonyholder.blogspot.com. Find it at cyberstationusa.com, radioforall.net, or simply subscribe to it on iTunes. You've forgotten all those places already, haven't you? Okay, just Google the title. It's called The Stuff File Program, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. Catch it, enjoy it, and have a chuckle or two. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Radio will never be the same again.
On shortwave, AM, FM, the internet, and via satellite, this is PCJ Radio.
Hi, this is Ian McFarland. If you're an SWL and feel nostalgic for the good old days of shortwave, you'll be interested in three sets of CDs that Colin Newell and I have produced. The first gives you 100 idents and interval signals from stations around the world. Then there's the foreign language recognition course that will help you identify the myriad languages that you can hear on shortwave. And the newest CD set, a look at the past 20 years in shortwave broadcasting with some of my broadcasting colleagues, and a look into the future. The proceeds from the sale of these CDs are in aid of a charity, a food bank for the less fortunate in my city of Duncan, British Columbia in Canada. Learn more about these CDs on the dxr.ca internet website. That's dxer.ca. Good listening, everyone.
Coming up, Finally Friday, with Neil Hendrickson.